We'll call this special council meeting to order. Mr. Acting Clerk, the roll call, please.
Your Worship, all members of council are present, except for Councillor Butler, who has a prior commitment, and Councillor McDermott, for personal reasons, and Councillor Zankel.
Which is the short way of saying that there are four of us here and three not. Okay, are there any disclosures of pecuniary interest? There being none, this is a training session with respect to water quality, and I'm going to call upon Mr. Brian Job. Say Job or Job?
Job.
And I don't know whether, Mr. Boutin, you wanted to say anything to kick this off. Well, then we'll start with you, and then you can introduce Mr. Job.
Thanks for the members of council and staff for attending. This has been a long time trying to pull this together, and I understand everybody has commitments of their own. This particular training course has been put together by the Waukesha Water Center, and as the title states, the statutory standard of care that certainly affects the members of council as the owner representative with respect to the management of our utility. We've been pretty successful over the years of communicating to you, but we afforded this opportunity for a third party like Brian with his expertise and the center's expertise to deliver this course. He indicated to me in some conversation tonight that he's delivered to over 3,000 councillors across the province in various terms. I think it should be a mandatory thing at every new term of council. If you haven't had this little training session, that there's some huge value there. So I look forward to Brian and his presentation, and I'll kick it off there. Brian, thanks.
Are you able to hear me from here okay? Should I almost move this up? Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks for the introduction, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. It's an important topic, as we all know. I want to point out to you there are two documents sitting in front of you. I think that the folks, did you get a chance to pick up the copies at the back there? There are two documents. The one with the black spline is essentially a copy of the presentation we're going to go through tonight, the PowerPoint slides. The other one is a guide that's been available for a number of years on the Minister of Environment and Climate Change website. Concerning it's a material that's the average councillor should know, what the average councillor should know about their water systems. And this material was developed by an advisory group of councillors and mayors from across the province. Small systems, large systems. This wasn't just pulled out of the air that things we thought, and we thought as water people. This was actually developed by people that are actually on council, sitting on council. Case in point would be former Mayor Deb Schufelt from the town of Goderich, who some of you may know. Real strong presence in the water industry and a real guiding light for us. This is really developed for junior councillors, people on council for the first time, that really didn't have any understanding of water and water systems. So a lot of work went into developing this material, and we're in the process of redeveloping it. So at the end of this, I've got a feedback form for the folks so that in the room, and I would appreciate any comments, things you'd like to see removed, things you'd like to see added, things you'd like to see changed. So I'll be really open to doing that, especially in light of the fact we're going into a new version. So it's broken up into four different units, an introduction at the start, talk about the legislation itself, and the concept called the multi-barrier approach. Then we talk about risk management, and we get into some case studies, and the case studies are where it gets real because people tragically lost their lives as a result of failures of drinking water systems. And then the final section is just a short section on things you can do going forward. I would welcome you to stop me anytime. If you have any questions, that's no problem at all. Keep this informal. Should point out that some of the material we've pulled for this is also from a gentleman named Dr. Steve Frutti from the University of Alberta. He has a tremendous ability to punch through all the fluff and get to the root of a problem. He's had a lot to do with the Waukesha Inquiry, but also drinking water guidelines in the UK and Australia. And we've used some of his information for this. Done some seminars for us. We've worked with him quite closely, and he's a breath of fresh air. he's retired, so he can say whatever he wants, how he actually feels, so it's kind of nice. Also, too, I had to fight for this, but we do have, for any operational people in the group, I know Grant is interested, but we have this eligible for continuing education unit, so operators can actually get CEUs for it. That may not be relevant to most of you, but in order for me to give you a nice little certificate, there's a short test. Now, the test is actually fun, and no one ever fails, so I do really encourage you to do that quickly at the end, and they can give you a nice certificate. Any questions now or in the future, anytime, that's my email, so I'd be more than happy to answer questions or try to get answers for you. A lot of times there are questions I can't answer, but sometimes answers are available. So just to start off, as we're all aware, safe drinking water is vital to the public health of your community. We're going to see that in the case studies. What is also important is it's important for the economic health of the community as well. When you look at the property values in Walkerton after the Walkerton tragedy, they plummeted. People did not want to move to Walkerton. People wanted to move out of Walkerton. It's recovered now for the most part, but that took a long time. And there's also the stigma that will be associated with Walkerton for a very long time, that, as we all know, what that stigma would be. In addition to that, residents of Ontario are expected entitled to expect that the water be safe. And municipal officials, people making decisions over water systems, have that responsibility to ensure. Come a long way in the last 100 years or so, and this is a quick graph of annual deaths, and this is information from the U.S. I don't have the same information from Canada, but you know, 400 or 500 people were dying every year from unsafe drinking water in the past. We saw a big drop-off in the middle part of the last century. Anybody want to guess what that drop-off might be a result of? It's the use of chlorine and the implementation of chlorine and the filtration, but primarily chlorine. So as a result, this is a good thing, but society expects this. There are three main messages here. The first thing, it is your duty as a councillor, as a representative of the owner of the system, it is your responsibility under the Safe Drinking Water Act to comply with the requirements of the statutory standard of care. It applies to anybody overseeing an operating authority. So I believe in this situation, the Region of Niagara would be your operating authority. So you're your own? Okay, so you are, if you, for example, you had Aqua running your water system for you, you would still be responsible under the standard of care as an overseer of Aqua, as an example. You probably would have representation on regional council for the water system. Okay. So there would be some responsibility there as well. There are legal consequences if you fail to carry out your duty. I'll talk about those in a minute. So the first one, it's your duty to do this. You need to be informed. This is a really important one. There's no expectation that anyone is going to have expert level knowledge on council, but you should keep yourself informed. You should be asking questions of your staff and getting answers, satisfying yourself with those answers. If, for whatever reason, you're not sure about the advice you're getting from anyone, then you are encouraged to seek out expertise and act on that advice. That could be advice from a peer municipality. It doesn't necessarily have to cost money. It could be a consultant. It could be an engineer. It could be a lawyer, depending on the nature of the question. And if you do seek out advice and you act on that advice and something goes wrong, will not be held accountable under the standard of care. It's only fair, but it's an important part of that. If you're making a decision and you're not really sure, and for whatever reason the information you're getting isn't good enough for you, seek out that expertise. And again, that expertise could actually come from in-house, from your own staff. That could come from an external source as well. So, important part. Be vigilant. When we look at the history of waterborne disease outbreaks, we see complacency is very often a factor. Very difficult to get rid of. It sounds easy, but complacency is one of those things that sets in and is difficult to shake. And you can't just assume all is well, and you do need to be asking questions and getting those answers and recognize, of course, that the health of your community depends on it. So, quick question. Aside from the standard of care, do owners of systems, and that would be council, have any legal responsibilities related to their water systems? Anybody aware of those? Might be. Partly, yeah. But even on a more basic level, this is something a lot of people aren't aware of this, but since 2002, councils have been responsible under Section 11 of the Safe Drinking Water Act, and that what that actually means is you're responsible for making sure your systems are in line up with the quality requirements, make sure that the operation of them is in accordance with the Act. You've got to have them properly maintain your systems, staff, supervisors, qualified people, and you have to comply with, as listed there, sampling, monitoring, testing, notification, reporting. An example of this might be reporting. On your website, you have your water quality results reported on the website. So that's something that one of the reasons that's there is either it was there before because it was a good practice or it's there because it's a requirement. So that's the old. That's been in place since 2002. What's new, or newer, is the Section 19, and this was December 31st, 2014 came into effect. When I started doing this presentation, it was coming up. So what the Standard of Care actually talks about is specific legal responsibility. Applies to anybody who is the representative of the owner, and that would typically be council, and actually applies to anybody above the level of a certified operator. So it actually applies to staff as well as council. And the wording from Justice O'Connor, and this was directly from the Walkerton Inquiry, is it requires the level of care, diligence, and skill that a reasonably prudent person would expect to exercise. It's a little bit vague, actually. And one of the reasons it's a little bit vague is because the courts would ultimately decide on what penalty, if any, were assigned. It also asks for honesty, competence, and integrity, and I think the electorate expects that of our elected officials anyway. It applies, as I mentioned, to the owner. In some cases, we do have corporate ownership of water systems, a little bit more rare these days, but in the recent past, the town of Iroquois Falls up north had Abitibi Bowwater actually owned the municipal water system. Farther up, we've got some mining companies that actually own the water system. Part of Greater Sudbury's system, municipal system, is owned by Valet, which used to be Inco. So there's corporate ownership. And if that's the case, every officer and director of that corporation is caught by the standard of care. And again, if you have someone as an operating authority, you would have responsibility and anybody overseeing that operating authority. So. Yes, sir.
Just going back to the responsibilities or being prudently reasonable in your knowledge, how do we know that we qualify or that we have that?
Well, this is what I mentioned is a little bit vague. You would be expected to exercise a level of care that a reasonably prudent person would be expected to exercise. It's definitely vague, but it's the courts that would decide whether or not you exercised your due diligence. It would be the, if it ever got to court, it would be the court that would be deciding that. That's an excellent question. There's no real answer for that though. If it were something pretty blatant, then that's when they're liable to be more trouble. But it's a good question. It really is. In terms of penalties, provincial officer can lay a charge if he thinks there's been a problem, a dereliction of duty, so to speak. There is a maximum penalty of $4 million and up to 5 years in jail. I can guarantee you the ministry is not sitting there waiting to lay a charge like this. They have no intention or no expectation to ever use it, but it is there just the same. And the penalties would be decided by the courts if something were determined to have been out of line. Clearly, if something bad happened and a lot of people were affected by it, it would be more severe consequence than if there were no outcome. But I will refer you quickly to the section in the guide on page 10. This is the little book with the white spline in the blue box on the left-hand side of page 10 of this, the blue book, is the complete wording of the Act. And it's actually fairly short. But I do want to refer you to number 5 near the bottom of that section, reliance on experts, because I think this is an important one. And it talks about a person shall not be considered to have failed to carry out a duty in any circumstance where they rely in good faith on the report of an engineer, lawyer, accountant, or other professional. So this, to me, is a really, it's only fair, but it's a really important part of this, is if you're not sure about something, if you're not sure about the decision you're making, get some help with making that decision. And that help can come from a professional, it can come internally, externally, but get some assistance with making that decision. Protection for yourself, really. So.
I just have one question. In the case, not really applicable to our situation, but you had said that in some cities, such as Sudbury, part of the municipal water system is owned by corporations. Are they held to the same standard of care penalties?
Absolutely. Yeah, they would be if they were shown to be dereliction of duty on their part. Sure, absolutely.
I was wondering if the private corporations that held it had a different set of penalties.
No, but in fact, it might be courts would tend to possibly look even harder on them than on a municipality, as you might be expected to see. I should also point out, too, this has never been tested. This is not something that has been, this charge has never been laid. There are a couple of situations that occurred prior to the enforced date of this, but in talking with ministry staff, they said, had this occurred after, there's a possibility, but it has not been tested yet. So let's hope it never is, but at this point it hasn't been tested. That's our goal, is to never have it tested. That would be the perfect world. We're going to switch gears a little bit now and talk about ways that you can ensure safe drinking water and ways we can minimize risk, because that's what this is really all about. The goal here is to not make anybody here experts, but to have a basic understanding of what goes on behind the scenes a little bit. We have intentionally pulled out the jargon and the acronyms and the buzzwords that we would typically use in this business, because it's much more easy to digest without them. And they're not really, frankly, they're not necessary. So we're going to talk about this concept called the multi-barrier approach. We have source water protection as the first barrier, treatment second, third as distribution, effective monitoring, and effective management. And they all collectively form a series of barriers to protect our drinking water, developed many years ago by the Canada Council of Ministers of Environment. And the idea is that if any one of these barriers breaks down, we will not have a problem, because the other barriers will be strong enough to take over. When we look at the history of waterborne disease outbreaks, it's when two or more of these barriers fail, we have a problem. When we look at the Walkerton tragedy, every single one of these barriers failed. So it was a ticking time bomb. It was not only was it an accident waiting to happen, and again, a couple minutes, we'll see that it was an accident that happened many, many times before, but it just wasn't a big enough accident for anyone to notice. So the first barrier, source protection, very complex problem, very expensive, very worthwhile doing, because it makes perfect sense to keep the contaminants out of the water in the first place. You have less to worry about going forward. But great difficulty in coming to terms with this. For a lot of municipalities. In the Wasaga Beach area, there are 22 different municipalities in one single watershed, and I can imagine trying to get 22 municipalities to agree on anything that involves cost sharing. Quite a complex problem. The province has pumped a bunch of money into it. They're continuing to. We're at a stage now where we have source protection plans that are being implemented, and there is some cost that municipalities are having to bear in the implementation of these plans. I don't want to dwell on this at all. There is information available through Conservation Ontario and through the MOE and Minister of Environment and Climate Change. But source protection is a barrier. It's the first barrier. It can be a good barrier for us to be using to keep our drinking water safe. The second barrier is treatment. This can be anywhere from simple chlorination of groundwater through to complex, highly sophisticated computer-controlled membrane systems. You have a fantastic plant here at Rose Hill. The region does, at least. I've worked in this area for many, many years and saw that plant in operation. And it's an absolutely state-of-the-art, fantastic plant. Last time I was there, mind you, I haven't been there in about 5 or 6 years at least. At the time, it was great, capable of producing excellent quality water. But it doesn't matter what kind of a system you've got in place. The critical role is to remove or inactivate pathogens. Pathogens are our greatest risk. Over time, there have been a number of different requirements under the Safe Drinking Water Act that have been put in place for everyone's protection. Not just the operators, not just public health, but as far as I'm concerned, these requirements help everyone, including the owner and councillor, because it's going to prevent something from happening. That's the bottom line, or prevent something from getting really bad, so it protects everyone. An example of this is the specific requirements for disinfection for every single facility in Ontario. So prior to Walkerton tragedy, really, there was a sort of a one-size-fits-all solution for disinfection. 0.5 milligram per liter of chlorine for 15 minutes. Good enough for everybody. Well, that wasn't the case in a lot of situations, so they decided to look specifically at every individual facility, and every facility now has a set of requirements associated with it. So that's a little bit of a fail-safe. Every operator knows that the requirements they have to meet for their facility to produce safe water. As we go through the presentation, there are a number of these fail-safes that have been put in place for everyone's protection. And I'll point them out because I think there's a bit of reassurance there for everyone. Distribution is the third barrier, and this is something that you are solely responsible for here in Fort Erie. I think it's really important to recognize that old infrastructure, leaky pipes, can be a source of entry for pathogens. You wouldn't think pressurized system, how could this possibly happen? But pressure fluctuations, pressure transients happen all the time in every town, and there are situations where those pipes can actually go into negative pressure or into suction. If there happens to be a leak there for whatever reason, it can actually pull contaminants back inside the pipe. It's a little bit of a newer area of research. Only the last 10 or so years people have been looking at it, but I know that there are some concerns about it in areas where are these. In other words, if there's a leak, sure, you're losing water, you're losing money, you're losing possible property damage, there are implications, but you could also have a very serious health risk there as well. Almost 20% of waterborne disease outbreaks, and this was in the 90s, were caused by problems in the distribution system. There are a number of issues associated with distribution, I call them problems in a way, because when you get inside the consumer's house, anything past the property line really is the consumer's property, and you really don't have free access to it. So that creates a whole bunch of other issues that we're not going to go into here, but you are responsible to the property line at least. And I think just recognizing that that's a barrier and you can keep that system properly maintained, that's going to help you with the production of safe drinking water. It doesn't mean you have to go up and dig all the pipes in town and replace them, but it means you have to be conscious of problems that can be created by problems in the distribution system. Fourth barrier is monitoring. I think it's important to recognize that just because you're taking more samples and doing more analysis doesn't necessarily make the water any safer, unless you're taking actions on those results. We encourage operators all the time to go looking for trouble. Don't go and take samples where you know it's going to be safe. Go to places that you think there might be a problem because that information is going to be a lot more meaningful for you. A couple more things are in place now, especially this mostly for the smaller systems because you would have had these in place for a while now, but continuous monitoring of some critical parameters like chlorine and turbidity. Turbidity is a measure of water clarity. It's an indicator of how well our systems are working, our treatment systems are working. So we have continuous monitoring instrumentation that tells us all the time, 24/7, what the chlorine is doing and what the turbidity is doing. And in some cases, we have automatic shutdown devices, again, mostly for the smaller systems. But there, again, it's a barrier. Those things are in place for our protection. Now the fifth barrier is management. We have to have strong regulatory requirements in the wake of the Walkerton tragedy. When you look at the regulatory neglect that was involved and identified in the Walkerton tragedy, the province really didn't have any choice but to come up with some pretty tough legislation. Similarly, though, the owner of the system also has to provide effective oversight. There's no question. So they would come under the management barrier. So all of those five barriers have to be in place, and they, you know, ideally they should be working well. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about risk management. I'm going fairly quickly through this because I know we started a bit late, and I know there's some appetite for moving quickly. So stop me if I'm going too fast. I'm more than happy to entertain questions as well as we go along. We'll talk a little bit about some of the more common risks for drinking water systems and ways to reduce risk. And this is, you know, a very, very quick discussion on risk management, nothing comprehensive at all, but just some concepts. First, I wanted to start with the fact that you already will have a risk assessment done for your system. Under the Drinking Water Quality Management Standard, there's a requirement that you have a drinking water quality management system in place, and I believe Sean is looking after that, under grant supervision. Part of that is an operational plan, and part of the operational plan is a risk assessment. So you will have to update that risk assessment periodically, depending on the frequency, every year or two, and make sure that that will look at or address any potential new risks that, that might. Things do change. Things happen. So another zebra mussel, God forbid, another problem like that come along, and you get a whole new set of risks. This has already been done. So these are things that are going on behind the scenes. You will be signing off on the DWQMS documentation when the management review and council buy-in period comes. So you will see some of this. But I think it's probably a good idea to ask for and maybe just quickly look at not the whole report, but the results, the summary of the risk assessment, just to see if there's any new risks that have been identified. It can be simple. You have a paragraph. Probably nothing. There probably won't be any new risks identified, but in the event that they are, council would probably want to be aware of them, and I'm sure you already are made aware if there are new risks identified. But so some comfort in knowing that this is going on all the time. We're talking about risk. We're talking risk from what? Risk from unsafe drinking water, really? Well, what is safe drinking water? And this is an interesting concept. It doesn't necessarily just mean, you know, meeting all the numbers on a page. It really means negligible levels of risk. And scientifically, we can't actually say zero risk, but we'd like to be able to. We can't actually call it zero. We need to get what we call negligible levels of risk. And Dr. Reardy used an interesting concept here. It's pretty basic, but he said the safe level is one that the average person wouldn't worry about. There are always going to be people in any population that are going to be worried about things for no reason, without good sound evidence, but the average person doesn't need to worry about it. Now, I can honestly tell you that the average person in Walkerton, after the tragedy, was worried about the quality of drinking water. So that's a situation where, sure, we've got unsafe drinking water. But to put it a little bit in other terms, I'll ask the question here, is the drinking water in your municipality here ever made anyone sick that you're aware of? Fair enough. Yeah, look at it compared to the cable TV bill or the newspaper bill or anything else. Gas, hydro. Yeah. Well, I remember the old adage, cheap as dirt. Last time I had dirt delivered to my house, it was about $85 a yard. And what's water? $2? Cubic meter? Buck and a half? No. So there's no right or wrong answer to this. There's no time frame on here. If people say no, absolutely not, I might be a bit concerned. Probably the most likely answer is they don't know or no. When we look at it, again, this is directly from the Walkerton tragedy. The fact is that most waterborne disease outbreaks go undetected. It has to be a relatively large number of people getting sick over a relatively short period of time for the healthcare system to even notice it. Looking back in history at the Walkerton tragedy, you can see the two peaks, the one on the left crosses that threshold, the one on the right doesn't. That's undetected. That would happen many, many, many times in Walkerton for 22 years prior to the outbreak. People were getting sick in Walkerton on a regular basis, but not enough people, in hindsight, this is of course all in hindsight, not enough people were getting sick at any one time for it to be identified as a waterborne disease outbreak. These can be traced directly back to the water. Mostly E. coli? Mostly E. coli? Absolutely. So it's interesting that, I can guarantee you that Walkerton is not the only place this was happening. Happening elsewhere. I'm not saying it was happening here at all, but places where the kind of activities operator, lack of operator ability, let's say, were happening elsewhere, because that was my job with the Minister of Environment, was out troubleshooting plants back in the 70s and 80s. So it was happening. And again, they say that only 3% of waterborne disease outbreaks are actually reported.
Looking at this here chart here on page 16, the undetected outbreak, did they come up with something that if this occurs in a certain number of times, then they will go and look at it as a detected outbreak?
I mean, they're getting more, looking more carefully at water now than they have been in the past. In the past, it was never thought that it was really even possible. But the water is always the last resort. The people that do the epidemiological studies when they're trying to sort out one of these outbreaks, is they'll look at person-to-person contact, food. They have like a checklist. And if nothing else fits, then it's like, well, it must be the water. In fact, we're going to see when we talk about the Waukegan tragedy, they did that three times. They went through that process, saying, okay, well, was it food? Is it person-to-person? Are there, do these people get together at an event, at a church social, at something? And just they just kept coming up with no as an answer. And they kept coming back to water. And unfortunately, they phoned the general manager and said, how are the test results? And he said the test results are fine, and he knew, in fact, they weren't. So this is...
yeah, but did they come up with a standard now?
There isn't really a standard
because... You're allowed like 5 or 8 undetected outbreaks, and then we're going to come in and do an investigation on our own? Even though it didn't reach the threshold for the healthcare system?
They would undergo the same kind of investigation. With 5 or 8, I'm not sure. They would probably start thinking about it, but again, it depends on the size of municipality. It depends on, 5 or 8 in Toronto is nothing, but it may be a lot in a population 5,000 town. Good question. I don't know if there's actually a specific number that they'd be looking at, but when they do start to notice a large number of people getting sick from something, then they're going to start to zero in. They're going to be more conscious of the water as being a potential, for sure, because of Waukegan. But it's a bit of an eye-opener, but it is reality. So we're talking about risk. I really quickly just want to point out what risk is. You're probably already aware that risk is a combination of two things, the hazard itself in the first place and the likelihood of it occurring. To use the example of the Ebola virus, very, very high level of hazard, kills 90% of the people it comes in contact with. But as far as an event goes, it could introduce it to our water system. It doesn't occur in this part of the world. It doesn't survive that well in water. So the likelihood of it occurring in our water system is pretty darn low. It's a combination of those two things makes the risk of Ebola virus in our water system extremely low, as opposed to a large diameter water main break, where you do have some significant risks. The likelihood of it happening is a lot higher. So the risk is a combination of the two things, the hazardous nature of the thing in the first place and the event, the likelihood of it happening. Recognize some principles in reducing risk. We look at the first thing is pathogens pose the greatest risk. This is what we have to be conscious of all the time. Pathogens are microbiological organisms that can make a human sick, a human pathogen. Robust multiple barriers are essential. We have to have these barriers I talked about earlier, those 5 barriers. They have to be tough. They have to be robust. Trouble is usually, not always, usually preceded by change. Operators have to be capable and responsive. Professionals need to be accountable. I'm going to talk about all these individually in a second. If we're going to be properly managing risks, we have to be making informed decisions. So to look at these, first of all, probably everyone knows the answer to this. Do you think there are pathogens in the raw water and treated water for your drinking water system? Everybody's nodding. So there, and even if there are, there, even if they're not, you have to assume they're there anyway. The only way you could maybe say no to this is if you had a really good, high-quality, deep, secure groundwater. Then it's questionable. You still have to assume they're there anyway, though. So pathogens pose the greatest risk. We know pathogens cause human disease. They're going to be everywhere people and animals are found, potentially, and they're never going to be far from water. Good news is we know how to deal with them. Our treatment processes know how to remove or inactivate these pathogens. So that's good news. This is a quick, this is the only technical slide in the whole deck, but this is a quick summary of pathogens that we are typically concerned about in drinking water. This is a relatively old slide, but it still holds true. These are still, this is the hit list. It's divided up into three groups, viruses, bacteria, protozoans. I'll point out the middle group there, the bacteria. One of the things that bothers me the most about the Wakanin tragedy is it was so easily prevented. The organisms that caused disease in Wakanin were so easily killed by chlorine. Name that the operator wasn't doing his job properly. So the first one is Campylobacter. University of Waterloo students went out and did a sampling of all the poultry in the grocery stores in the area around campus. They pulled chicken and turkey in the nice little vacuum packs off the shelves, and they looked at it for Campylobacter, and they found over 80% of the poultry was contaminated with Campylobacter. Tell you to cook your chicken. My daughter had a Campylobacter infection about 20 years ago now, and it developed into what's known as Guillain-Barré syndrome. She was four, and we spent 2 weeks in Sick Kids Hospital with the doctor scratching their head saying, we don't know what this is, we don't know what this is. She couldn't walk, she couldn't talk, she couldn't feed herself, her eyes were crossed. It was horrible. As a parent, it's one of the worst things you go through. Everyone heard about in Wakanin was E. coli, but 40% was Campylobacter. The EH in front of the E. coli stands for enteral hemorrhagic, which means it causes hemorrhaging. The vast majority of E. coli out there is non-toxic. It's not dangerous. We have E. coli in all of our mammals have E. coli as part of our natural digestive system. It's important to point out, when we get a water sample that has a positive for E. coli, it's not the dangerous E. coli we're looking for there. That's the good E. coli that we're looking for, and it's an indicator there might possibly be some other pathogen in there. Positive for E. coli does not mean we've got the bad E. coli in our water. It's just an indicator. So, Giardia and Crypto are the last two. They're protozoans. These things are of concern because they can form these cysts or oocysts, and they can lie dormant in the bottom of a lake or river. They can freeze and still be viable. They can last for months or years. So they can get into a water system, lake or river, usually not in groundwater, and they can be drawn into a water plant and you have a real problem with these. In 1993 in Tomogamy, the largest outbreak of Giardia was recorded. And you think of Tomogamy, pristine wilderness, but it was from wildlife. Yeah, exactly. So they all have, for the most part, they can be controlled by chlorine, except for the last two, Giardia and Crypto. The bacteria, for sure. Most of the viruses are controlled by chlorine as well, even though this here says moderate. There are a couple viruses that have some ability to survive chlorine, but most of the viruses are effectively controlled by chlorine as well. But the cryptos, because these Cryptosporidium and Giardia form these cysts or oocysts, it's like a little seed. And it's got like a shell on the outside of it almost, and the chlorine can't penetrate it. So we have to rely on other things, which we do. We have other technologies for removing them. Majority of them can come from animals, but certainly people. So this remains the list of pathogens we're trying to remove, trying to make sure aren't there. So pathogens are the greatest risk. We do have other things we need to worry about. We have regulations we have to meet. We know the high levels of arsenic, fluoride, selenium, nitrate, lead can pose a health risk. Some cases we have pesticides that are around depending on where you are geographically and agriculturally. There can be problems that are usually pretty site-specific, and they're generally speaking, they're fairly uncommon, but there still are regulations to meet. So don't want to say that these other contaminants are not a concern, because they are, but they pale in comparison to the risk from pathogens. Second barrier, we have to have these barriers in place that have to be tough. We shouldn't just have those barriers there because the regulations say we have to. We should look at optimizing the performance of those barriers, and this is something that operators are doing all the time. And this isn't a new concept, it's been around for a long time, but we have to have these barriers in place if we're going to get down to these negligible levels of risk we want. It's also going to help us because we know it's inevitable, people are going to make mistakes. have these barriers in place so that if someone doesn't make a mistake, it won't cause a disaster. One of the problems with this, though, in terms of multiple barriers, a perception of undue or expensive overkill, redundancy. But if we are, we do need to have a little bit of this redundancy if we are going to get into this low levels of risk. But I'll use the example of the this cost-effective curve, get to the point of diminishing returns. If we decided, okay, forget all these barriers, let's just put all our eggs in one basket. Let's just build the best water plant we can find, and then we don't have to worry about anything else. We can spend all your money on the water plant and then put that pristine water into a leaky old distribution system, and you wouldn't be any further ahead. So you're actually better off to have all of the barriers working in a cost-effective fashion, and you'll end up getting more bang for your buck that way anyway. Trouble is usually preceded by change. Somewhere around 70% of outbreaks have occurred after some kind of extreme weather condition. I know from experience at the Dunnville water plant, a couple miles over, when the operators were going to work and the wind was blowing from the east, they knew they were going to have a fun day because the Grand River water would be blown across, redirected across their intake. And Lake Erie water and Grand River water are quite different. So it was just a change. But they knew that. This is a seasoned operator. He knows that. And he reacts to it accordingly. And there's absolutely no substitute for a seasoned operator working in your system. Training can help and will help, but experience is just as important. The fourth barrier is having capable and responsive operators. We know people are going to make mistakes, as I mentioned earlier. It's human nature. But having somebody who's well-informed and competent and dedicated is the best way we can achieve water safety. If you went to your operator and you said, Grant, what's the chances of us having a cryptosporidium outbreak in our system? And if Grant said, never going to happen in a million years, don't worry about it, I'd be asking Grant more questions. But if he said, well, you know, we're doing this to make sure it doesn't happen. You know, the region's got their treatment in place, and we get reports from them all the time, and we got disinfection going on. Much better answer. Being able to admit that it could happen is really important, and that makes you maintain your vigilance. Learning from past mistakes is really important, and I mentioned that gentleman, Dr. Hrudy, at the start, and he's published a couple of books. One of them is an in-depth investigation to a whole bunch of waterborne disease outbreaks that have occurred around the world. His most recent book is post-Walkerton, and there are dozens and dozens of them in large cities in Europe and UK. And it's actually kind of surprising that some of the things that have happened. So we look at this as an opportunity in teaching and training to make sure that people are aware of these things that happen so we can, and some of them seem so stupid, but you don't think about it. So this, get this information out in front of the operators, let them start thinking about these kind of things. And it actually works really well. It's a very effective way for training. One thing that's good about this industry is people do tend to share their information, and they'll even share their mistakes and failures. Other industries tend to be very protectionist, but water industry, we love talking about these things and helping each other. So it's a great business from that perspective, and we can learn from it. Another little bit of comfort for you and the public, I guess, really, is the operator certification program we have in Ontario is really second to none in the world. We have operators trained at least as good or better than any other jurisdiction in the world. So we also have training requirements that are very, very strict. And the training does need to be targeted to the specific operator. We do sometimes have operators that are sent to training just because it's convenient. It's a really good idea to have a training plan in place so that operators get the relevant training that they need. We're finding that's pretty much the case. There are some minor exceptions here and there, but in some municipalities, but for the most part, it's happening. We are going to continue to have problems with small systems in the sense that some of the very small systems have a single operator. In some cases, they're sharing an operator between two or three municipalities for a number of different reasons, cost, availability of a certified operator, period. Sometimes they're just not there. Sometimes there's no one there that can meet the qualifications to become a certified operator. So some real challenges in the small systems, especially in the north, more remote locations, and we're working really hard to try and find ways to deal with that. Sure.
What's considered a small operation? The region, what we have here around the region, that we
no.
like medium, big, or?
Not by any definition. There are different, many, there are about 10 different definitions of small systems out there. The American Water Works Association is anything smaller than 10,000 population. There's 5,000 population. The Ministry of Environment, I think, is 5,000 and smaller. We're talking here in this situation with these systems where there might be 100 or 200 people, or maybe 500 people. And pretty hard to, with a tax base like that, it's pretty hard to afford a full-time operator and all the things. So sometimes they share an operator. No, your system here would definitely not be considered small by any stretch. Operator challenges there. Drinking water professionals need to be accountable. We drill this home in all the training we have for our drinking water operators. We have mandatory training. Actually, there's mandatory recertification for drinking water operators. Not too many trades or professions have mandatory retraining. But every 3 years, our drinking water operators have to take a mandatory course, in addition to, generally speaking, anywhere between 20 and 50 hours of training. What we try to do in this training is make sure that people are aware of the fact that they should really go look for problems. Don't try to hide from problems. Go look for trouble in your system, because it can give you much more meaningful information. Make sure you listen to consumer complaints. When we look at many outbreaks that have happened, had they responded to consumer complaints a little bit more quickly, they would have realized, hey, there's a real problem here. A large number of consumer complaints don't have any basis, but there's a significant percentage that do. So it's important to make sure, and that would be something that you would do on the staff level, and I'm sure can guarantee you that there's a program you would have for investigating consumer complaints quickly, as most municipalities do. Make sure that there's an obligation, too, on the part of staff to inform council, to inform the owner, about problems. So staff are bringing information to you. There's an obligation on them to make sure you are aware of these things, too. So positive. You get swamped with all those reports. It's because he has to. So finally, risk management means an informed decision-making. Sounds easy trying to be preventive rather than just reactive, you know, establish the greater risk from the lesser ones. Well, that's not always that easy to do. Clearly dealing with the greater risk first, but again, it takes a little bit of knowledge and information. It takes a little bit of basic understanding, I think, understanding of your system in order to determine what those risks are. This is where you can actually help rely on staff to a large degree to help you determine, you know, what is the real risk here. So just to summarize risk management, you have an operational plan. It has an assessment of risk already. That's already been done, and it's going to be updated every periodically. I would suggest that one action council could take is just look at those risks, if there are any identified. Just a high-level summary. Any risks? Yes, no. If yes, some kind of a plan in place to deal with them. It doesn't have to be done tomorrow. It does depend on the nature of the risk, obviously, but just to have some way to address them, something in place to address them. Normally I take a break here. I don't know if you want me to keep going. I can do that as well. It's entirely at your discretion. Going, and then we can get through. Okay. Because a break turns into 10 minutes, turns into 20 minutes. So this is actually the interesting part of the presentation. Tragic and interesting, I guess, at the same time. We'll talk about the Walkerton disease outbreak that everybody is somewhat familiar with. Disease outbreak in North Battleford, Saskatchewan, that you may or may not have heard of. And we ended on a little bit of a lighter note with not a tragic outbreak, but a contamination event in Stratford, Ontario. And we look at these from sort of two perspectives. Point of view of the multi-barriers that we talked about earlier, but also from the point of view of the responsibility of councils and owners and oversight, people with oversight. We'll start off with Walkerton, May 2000. Everybody was aware of this to some degree. Shallow groundwater well contaminated with cattle manure. About half the population were sick. And here's that E. coli again. In this case, as opposed to having an EH in front of it, the E. coli actually has the specific strain, which is a 15787. That's the nasty, specific nasty strain of E. coli. Campylobacter. Both bacteria, both easily controlled by chlorine. So here we've got the numbers. The numbers are kind of misleading. Here we've got 65 hospitalized, 27 developed kidney disease, 7 people died tragically. But currently there are still about 85 or 90 people who are on premature dialysis, waiting for kidney transplants. And then you multiply that by the number of family members that would be affected by that. And then you look at the people that were sick and passed away. It's a lot more than 7 people. It's hundreds of people's lives. And this is one thing we talk about with operators all the time is, for the sake of those people who lost their lives, not in Walkerton, but elsewhere as well, we need to make a commitment to never let this happen again. And we get buy-in. We get buy-in. So as everyone's, I'm sure, aware, there was a public inquiry called by Justice O'Connor to figure out how it happened and how we can stop it from happening again. So just to do a quick rundown of what actually did happen. So in May of 2000, heavy rainfalls during the second week of May. This is where the lab called the general manager, told him the water samples failed. So they talked to him on the phone, contacted him directly and said the water samples failed. They also faxed the results to him. And on 3 occasions after that, the health unit, and they're doing their, as I mentioned before, like their checklist, they, you know, trying to determine the source of the outbreak, kept coming back to water. They'd phone him. He said water was fine. They go back through their process again. It wasn't until the third time they didn't trust the information they were getting from him because they just had no other possible way that it had to be the water. They did their own tests, and that's when they did. Sir.
Just looking at that, do they have it now that you have to send the results in instead of just giving it to them verbally?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that have happened. And we're going to get to them, one of the things that happened in the day, there wasn't any requirement for the lab to send the test results to the ministry or to the Ministry of Health or Environment. All they had to do was send the lab results to the client. Now, that was a result of privatization of labs. Prior to Walkerton, all the bacteriological work was done by Ministry of Environment labs in London, Kingston, Toronto, Sudbury, and Thunder Bay. All the samples went there. Bad result, ministry knew instantly. Those labs were privatized. They were shut down. They still ran other contaminants, but the bacteriological part of those labs were shut down. The private sector picked it up and charged for it, of course. Private sector didn't have a requirement to send the lab results to the ministry or to the Ministry of Health. They just sent it to the client with the expectation the client would pass them on. But if the client chose to hold on to that information, then nobody else found out about it. That did change. If you are a lab now, the requirements on a drinking water lab to do testing now are astronomical. But one of them is very clearly, any adverse result for anything automatically has to be reported to the Ministry of Environment and Ministry of Health. In fact, it's kind of scary. If you write drinking water on a sample bottle and a lab gets it, it's panic. If you're doing some tests in the lab, we do some tests in the lab, and if you put drinking water and you send it out for analysis, you put drinking water anywhere on that sample of you send to a lab, it's a new level of concern, because if there's anything bad in there, even if it's just a test you're doing, bad in there, it hits the fan. So have to be careful. Did that answer your question okay? Yeah, we're going to come up to some of those other changes that have happened. The health unit questioned, concern was raised, questioned, and it wasn't until the third time that they did their own tests and found the results were bad. And then on the third week of May, a week later, the first victim died. It was a significant rainfall event, pictures of the river before and during the storm, but this was supposed to be a deep, secure groundwater. So should heavy rains have any effect on deep, secure groundwater? Fine. So it was also a bit of an indication that, hey, this was not, in fact, the deep, secure groundwater after all. Fortunately, they found that out too late. So Well 5 was the offending well. It was commissioned in 1978. It was contaminated during initial testing, and every single test after that showed signs of contamination. The ministry gave them approval to use a well, but only as a backup well, and only if they use chlorination along with it. And at the time in 1978, chlorination was not a blanket requirement for all wells. Despite the problems with that well that they were aware of, they didn't do any inspections at all in the 80s. Inspections program was not very robust in the 80s. They did do a DNA analysis and determined that the bacteria was the same. So the bacteria that were causing the problem in the humans were, in fact, from the cattle based on the they determined also the chlorine wasn't being properly applied. They could determine that because they knew that had the operator been applying the chlorine he was supposed to be, those bacteria would have not survived. They also came out in the inquiry. Interestingly, too, when they're doing the investigation, they were operating the well. The well's in a bit of a shallow, there's a bit of a built-up area, a couple of shallow areas, little ponds beside the well. And when they're operating the pump, the water level in those ponds would drop. A little bit of an indication that there's a connection with the surface there. You could actually physically see the water level in those ponds drop, and they're small. The operators said that they were using well 5, even though they really weren't supposed to be using it as a production well. They're using well 5 because they can get soft water at a low cost. Now, any operator that I know would realize that if you're getting soft water deep in the ground in that part of Ontario, it's not groundwater. It's soft because it's coming from the surface. And it sort of highlights in my mind the skill level, knowledge level of these operators. That's a quick picture of the farm itself. Manure was spread on the surface. The water didn't actually run across the very top surface of the land, and it actually went down to the bedrock and traveled along the bedrock into the, it was a fairly shallow overburden there, into the bedrock, into a broken well casing, into the well, right down over the very top, but just below the surface. Chronology of the events, contamination occurred around May 12th. Had the operator done his job, he probably would have picked this off either on May 12th or possibly May 13th. Lab results were reported on the 17th. People started getting sick on the 18th. This all happened fairly quickly. Yeah, health unit got involved and realized that they were getting misinformation on testing and determined fairly quickly that oil water advisory needed to be issued. Fortunately, it was too late for the victims that did pass away. And this was over a long weekend, and we all kind of heard about it on the Sunday and the Monday of that long weekend. But fairly short timeline. So to look at this from the point of view of the different barriers we talked about before, and where I can insert knowledge of what council knew and didn't know. So the source water protection barrier. Well, that well was known to be contaminated for 22 years prior. The well probably never should have been commissioned in the first place, and probably wouldn't be by today's standards. So you could look at that and say, well, the source water protection, well, in addition to that, the geology was fractured limestone, and the geology of that bedrock was vulnerable. So the fine never been approved. So the source protection barrier failed. Treatment barrier, the only thing they had for treatment was chlorine. Yes, sir.
Who approved the well? And then
Minister of Environment.
So if they approved the well, then council went forward with using the well based on...
Yeah, they approved the well as a backup well, not as a production well, so it wasn't being used for what it was intended for, and they approved it with the use of chlorine. And the use of chlorine implies that the proper use of chlorine, and the operator was not. Had the well been properly chlorinated, it wouldn't have been a problem. But it wasn't, so it was a combination of things. But realistically, contamination of a well, it probably never should have been approved in the first place. Probably. But it was.
I'm trying to get at is, how does it get to the council's responsibility? Because they're approving different things. And like you said, it should have never approved the well in the first place because it goes back years.
Yeah, we're not really at the council responsibility here yet because I don't think, you're right, I don't think there's anything here that council could have been or should have been responsible for. Council would have hired a consultant to look at the well production. a licensed well driller and a consultant to put the well in, to construct the well. So they'd be relying on that expertise. So you wouldn't, I wouldn't say there's anything there at all that council should be responsible for. I think the ministry, you know, was really responsible for approving that well in the first place. And I think by today's standards, that well wouldn't be approved. But again, it was being used for something different than what was intended. But that was an operational call. That wasn't a call by council. So as far as I know. The treatment, all they had for treatment was chlorine. They didn't do any other physical treatment or chemical treatment at all. They just used chlorine for disinfection. The operators were not measuring the chlorine properly. This came out of the Guakerson inquiry. What he would do, the operator, he would go to the pump house at the start of every month. He would fill out the dates for the month ahead. He would put all the chlorine residual numbers in for the month ahead, put the clipboard back up on the wall, and walk out. He admitted this in the inquiry. So you can imagine all your neighbors around you at the inquiry talking about this. It would have been pretty tough. But he did admit to that. There certainly wasn't enough chlorine going in, and if any at all, I guess it was a little bit of a concern, a little bit of a uncertainty as to whether he was adding chlorine at all. Certainly wasn't measuring it properly. So the treatment barrier failed. There were all kinds of problems that were identified in distribution and storage, including newly installed water main that wasn't disinfected at all. They found dead animals in the reservoir. There were a number of different problems that were identified, but none actually contributed to this, as it turns out. But you could still say that distribution and storage barrier failed. The monitoring barrier, I guess this was where, when I was mentioning to you before, operator was falsifying the records and getting a little bit creative, so he made it look like he was actually in some slight fluctuation, but he admitted to falsifying all the numbers. In addition to that, when operators are taking samples in the system, they will typically go to look at the extremities of the system to make sure that there's some residual chlorine at those, you know, those dead ends and such. So they would get their sampling equipment together and go out and take samples. Well, he would get all his bottles together, label them at all different locations, Essel Station, Mrs. Smith's house, so we cover up, and then fill them all up in the same tap in the PUC office. Essentially falsifying that he'd taken those samples for. And I was trying to think of, why would someone do that? And I guess, like, I'm just trying to get my mind into it personally, because, you know, I've been around with operators for 30, 35 years, and it's either these rules are not for me. It's possibly a little bit of complacency, so this water's fine and no one's ever gotten sick and I don't need to take all these samples. But I really don't have a good answer as to why he would do that. It's a tough one. Possibly a bit of complacency, possibly a bit of laziness, I'm not sure. At the time, and I mentioned this already, at the time the lab only had to report to the client. In this case, they only reported to the general manager. Prior to this and now, absolutely, you'll lose your license as a lab if you don't automatically report an adverse to the local health unit and the local MOE office. You absolutely have to do that immediately if you get a bad result. So any lab doing any drinking water testing is required to do that. Another little bit of another fail-safe that's been put in place. Management, the final barrier. Suggestion was that council didn't provide proper oversight. There had been some issues that the MOE had raised before, prior to 2000. The Ministry of Environment inspections, they weren't very often, but the ones that they had done, they had identified some deficiencies. They had identified some issues with the operator certification. The operators were properly certified, and that is a requirement of council to make sure that operators are maintaining their training and certification. There were some, there were a number of issues that were identified that council did not act on, but the ministry didn't follow up on them. So you could look at that two ways, and you could say, okay, sure, the council didn't act, but if they knew there was going to be no consequence, why would they act? It's sort of like getting a speeding ticket. If we didn't have to pay our speeding tickets in order to renew our driver's license, we might not. So I guess you could look at both. But there was some suggestion that council probably should have provided better oversight. Falsified data, lack of staff training. Councils should be signing off on training budgets, so there should be some awareness of training. And again, you can rely on staff to make sure that they're getting the training hours. You would certainly hear about it if they weren't getting the proper training hours, because the MOE inspections that are now every year and very, very thorough, there's a report that you would get if they weren't. Back in the day, it wasn't so vigorous. Falsified data is an interesting one. Personally, I cannot think that anybody could expect council to be responsible for an operator falsifying records. That's the kind of behavior that you would not expect from a reasonably prudent person on the part of the operator. I don't think that council could be or should be, and we'll never know because this was never tested. But if we're looking at Walkerton and saying, okay, let's put this to the standard of care test, to say that council should be responsible for the falsified data and the fraudulent and deceitful behavior on the part of the operator, I personally don't think that could be. There are maybe some other things that could be, you know, again, not responding to issues raised, but there are some things that I really don't think. And the regulator failed in the oversight role in terms of inspection approval of all number 5, absolutely, there's no question. Problems with the regulatory. So that's the management barrier. Justice O'Connor has said failure at all levels, complacency at most levels. It wasn't just one thing that happened. There were a whole bunch of factors came together. It was a perfect storm in a sense, but this perfect storm had been brewing for a previous 22 years. And again, the thing that bothers me the most is it could have been so easily prevented. This was something that definitely did not have to happen and should never have happened. So as we mentioned, the contamination automatically has to be reported to the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Environment. The cost of the outbreak, the last number I heard was $72 million. I think it's up from that. They did spend $10 million in upgrading the system, but in reality, solution to the problem would have cost absolutely nothing. All they had to do was switch off to that well pump and maybe spend $1,000 to cap the well. But that they really would have cost next to nothing to solve. The other two wells were fine. So. Sir?
Just give me a little better understanding of what chlorine residual is.
Okay, we add chlorine to the water to disinfect. In any water, unless it's absolutely like distilled water or deionized water, any water is going to have a little bit of organic material in it, some iron, and it'll actually use up some of the chlorine. So what's left is all we have to do the work. So a little bit. So we add 10 parts of chlorine. 2 get used up. So we've got 8 left, right? It's that 8 that does the work. We call that chlorine residual. Yeah, so next case study is North Battleford, Saskatchewan. This was after Walkerton. This was another situation where pretty close to half the population of us of North Battleford were sick with Cryptosporidium. And this is that parasite, that organism that forms that oocyst I was talking about before. Turns out that it's kind of gross, but these outbreak originated in the city sewage plant, which was 3.5 kilometers upstream of the intake. Not sure what they teach in engineering school, but I think page 1, chapter 1 would be locate sewage plant downstream of the water plant. But apparently there was some, the city took over an old mental health facility or something. There was a reason. About half the population were sick. Public inquiry called, much like Walkerton inquiry. This is a picture of the North Saskatchewan River flowing from Alberta down through North Saskatchewan. See if I can get this mouse up here. The city argued, here's a sewage outfall here. This is the river running this way. This is the drinking water intake. The city argued that the sewage, and this was really just a trickle of water, the sewage would come into the river here, go upstream, and around the other side of the island and miss the drinking water intake. That's what the city argued. I haven't seen sewage flow upstream too often, but apparently it was they dug their heels in and they would not admit. And I think maybe they had advice from a lawyer to not admit. Photo of it and said, here's the sewage. And again, this was just a trickle, fairly shallow river at this point. And the sewage would just went pretty much straight down from the sewage outfall 3.5 kilometers upstream, and then the drinking water intake was down here at the bottom of the picture. Had a history of problems here dating back to the 60s, actually. Just prior to the tragedy that they had in 2001, they had low bacteria or low chlorine level and coliform bacteria showing up. Again, not necessarily dangerous, but indicators. And this was actually in response. This was September 2000. So this was a little bit more vigilance as a result of the Washington tragedy. You saw this at a lot of places. And in fact, this plant foreman who was watching what happened in Washington very closely, he ended up retiring. First of all, he took a stress leave. Operators moved over, and they were trying to do the right thing. Maintenance of the budget. What actually happened was he took a stress leave. He said, I can't take this pressure. There's going to be a problem here. Both the water and the sewage plant needs upgrades. I can't take it. Came back from his stress leave, tried to work through it a bit, and then he took early retirement and said, I just can't do it. Tried to convince council and senior management that problems here, this was necessary work that needed to be done. Something bad was going to happen, and I can't take the pressure, so retired. It's pretty significant if someone's going to be taking a not only a stress leave, but early retirement because of... the plant itself actually used chlorination as a disinfectant. Now, we all, in the business, we all are aware that, and I showed Guardia was the other one that forms the cistern. For all intents and purposes, it's totally resistant to chlorine. It's not that it developed resistance to it, it always had been resistant. So chlorine as a disinfectant is pretty much effective for this organism. So all they really had was their filtration process. They had a conventional regular plant with filtration. Very effective, absolutely fantastic. But the treatment process has to be working properly in order for it to be effective. So when the junior staff were working on it, they did a repair, they didn't follow the proper procedures, and they compromised that ability for those filters to work. If they aren't working properly, these oocysts can get right through the filter. Chlorine's not going to work as a disinfectant. Here's a quick graph of the dates. At the bottom in black was normal operation, and the little dashed line there at 319 was maintenance on the plant, and the gray bars are cases of cryptosporidium. Public drinking water advisory was there on the 4th. Actually, look at that. You see that there's a period where 5.5 weeks where this problem before the problem was identified and the public drinking water advisory was called. So in other words, for about 5.5 weeks, the city kept arguing with public health that no, this isn't a problem, not our water system. And the province got involved, and there was a big battle going on between all three, and partly because the city would refuse to.
Just looking at all of that, just hearing what you're saying, people were coming to a council and they were going to the, I guess, staff and saying, we have a problem here, we need to fix this, and they were refusing to do it. Is there something in place now by the ministry that says if this occurs, Grant has the authority to override the council and his senior staff to make sure that these things get done, or so he can report that to somebody?
No, there isn't, but that, in fact, is the intent, in part of the intent of the standard of care of what we talked about earlier. I mean, If blatant refusal to look at or look at information that's coming to you from staff like that, that could be a problem for you.
Well, this foreman had a problem. Obviously, he recognized it. He knew better than anybody else,
right.
And they just wanted to ignore him.
Yep.
And the ministry hasn't put anything in place yet to prevent.
Well, the standard
that.
Of care is there, but it's a penalty against the council. Now, in Saskatchewan, this is in Saskatchewan, which is different. They don't have this yet. But in Ontario, if that had happened here now and Grant came to you and said, we desperately need something, and you know, it would have to be pretty concrete, you as a counselor would be punishable under the standard of care.
Yes, I understand that, but I'm only punishable once something happens, right? Is that what? That's where I'm going.
Unfortunately, we're going to
override Grant until somebody gets injured or somebody gets hurt or somebody gets sick or somebody dies, and then they'll come back and say, "Well, you should have let him do that." The ministry should be saying, "If Grant comes forward and this problem occurs, he can override you if he comes to the ministry and says, look, we have to do this."
I guess the other thing too is we would expect that there are inspections done every year. The ministry does do very, very thorough and very exhaustive inspections. They would identify potential issues like that, especially if they're significant issues. But that's a good point. To my knowledge, now Grant could go to the ministry directly in the situation you described, and that would certainly cause that would definitely trigger some action. There's no question. I don't know what exactly charges, probably. Potentially, but as far as ability to take over the operation, I don't think that's. Or maybe perhaps it shouldn't be. It's. Well, that, I think that's where the province would come in. In fact, Flint, Michigan was. Again, for different reasons, but it was more financial. But the state took over the operation of Flint, Michigan, the whole city. Led to the lead issue. All they were looking at is the bottom line. Get the dollars down, because we're broke. But that backfired on them in a big way. So. But that's an interesting concept. I don't know. I think you probably have a little trouble convincing councils that was a good idea. Generally, to have allowed these staff to take over. Yeah. Right. And I think the ministry would be looking at that pretty closely. I mean, if, again, inspections revealed problems, inspections are thorough. Water quality as well. I mean, there would have to be some water. And this is an interesting situation in a sense. This is pretty blatant for a number of different reasons, as you'll see that as we go through this. Well, the direct cause was sewage contamination. That was determined. What's kind of gross, though, is more and more people were sick. It was a failure of the water plant and the sewage plant. So more and more people got sick. It was like a positive feedback loop. Coming on for 6 weeks, which you shouldn't have. Operators... we're trying to do the right thing. So this wasn't a situation of fraudulent, deceitful behavior on the part of the operators. This was more of junior, inexperienced operators that didn't know what they were doing. They lost a senior operator. The junior guys didn't have as much experience. Council and senior management kept pushing back, so they were trying to do the right thing, but they're getting blocked at every step. Province wasn't involved at all at the time. Common sense revolution, where it was trying to save money and cut taxes, but to look at this from the point of view of the different barriers, the source protection barrier, there wasn't any watershed program in any place at the time. Long history of problems at this particular plant, back to the 60s. They hadn't taken any action on past problems, and the city apparently disputed the theory about sewage contamination. Eventually, all the experts are saying, well, this is the only way it could happen, and they're still saying it happened that way. So, think council. The treatment step, the only thing they had there was chlorination for disinfection, and chlorination doesn't work on this particular organism. This is one of the very few organisms that chlorine is virtually used. timing of their equipment repair. They thought it was a good time of the year. It turned out to be a bad time of the year because the water does funny things at very cold temperatures. It's actually more dense at 4 degrees Celsius. So that has an effect on treatment processes that I'm aware of in this case. And that quite a long period of ineffective performance of the water plant that any seasoned operator would have recognized, that that shouldn't have been tolerated. The operators should have recognized that, but again, they also didn't understand what their system wouldn't do. They didn't know the limitations. But again, it wasn't through any kind of fraudulent behavior. It was just lack of. There weren't any problems noted with distribution and storage in this particular situation. From the monitoring point of view, again, experience and training was the most important thing. They were using some procedures that were not up to date, not current. There's some tests they were doing that they didn't need to be doing, and other tests they should have been doing, they weren't doing. So monitoring, you say that barrier failed. And then management barrier, the owner wasn't providing the resources to run the system properly. A regulatory neglect was a factor as well. The problems hadn't been. Really poor communications between all the players involved. And again, this should have never gone on for 6 weeks. 6 weeks is a long time. So just to wrap this one up, like Walkerton, the failure at virtually all levels. Some evidence that our operators are trying to do the right thing. This is the one that gets me the most, is they had a large contingency fund set aside for repairs. They had the money to do it. Like, I can see the difficulty in a lot of municipalities is when there's no resources, you know. One thing I do know is this council wasn't reelected. Question, I know that they're not there. They weren't there after the election. A number of councillors stayed on. It wasn't, again, in Walkerton, it was really, involvement of council was really questionable. Like, the responsibility of council was really why they weren't. What happened in Walkerton is the general manager would come to the council meetings. How are things? Everything's great, because he thought that's what they wanted to hear. He might have known full well they weren't, but that's what he said. So that's a kind of a hard thing to say. Well, you should have known. Well, gassed him. He came to the meeting and he said everything was fine. So that's what we're saying with this is, you know, great to come meet, you know, information comes to your meetings, but ask a few more questions. Make sure the risk assessment's not, you know, talking about the risk assessment. There's annual reports that come out. High-level summary, get the MOE inspection report. I'll talk about that. Every year, the MOE does an inspection. Look at the high-level summary of that. If it's times it'll be good, there might be something or one or two things. And these inspections are so thorough. If an operator writes in a logbook in pencil instead of pen, that's a non-compliance. They identify anything, and they're probably going to find something. If they don't find anything, fantastic. But occasionally, they will find something, usually a minor consequence. But be aware of it and deal with it. You know, put a plan, get a plan going, and. So the provincial government was aware of the problems, hadn't expected in 10 years. And it really boils down to those operators that were lacking experience. Last I heard, again, out-of-court settlements were $3.2 million. No one died that I'm aware of. I did hear that there were some, in a situation like this, you have in the old age facilities, nursing homes, sometimes in hospitals, you have people dying of multiple causes. Like, they're near the end of their life anyway, so there's a bunch of different factors involved, and there was some suggestion that in some cases, cryptosporidium was partly instrumental in this, but reports of people dying. And it also, it's kind of a funny one too, because it has a large catchment area as well, so that there's, it's a bit of a regional center, so probably, you know, would seem like more than 15,000 probably supports, the businesses would support a larger population from outside. I don't know how much they had in the fund, but they had money put aside in the contingency fund. I my understanding, they did have the money to cover it, but well, don't forget too, at this time, this was a common sense revolution. This was a time where you're trying to cut taxes in back then. Okay, the question that comes up then is, as a, if you're a councillor in North Battleford, what would you have done differently? I kind of know the answer there. You got a big pot of money. It's earmarked for this application, so you probably listening to your senior. It's one thing. Another thing about this one is you got a senior operator that's going to leave. You got to think about all that experience that's going out the door. That's the conclusion. I can, you know, owe me a beer on this one. Okay, the last case study, we'll end this on a lighter note, a positive note. This is Stratford, Ontario. Everybody knows where Stratford is. It's the birthplace of Justin Bieber, I think. Maybe, who's that newscaster? Remember, Justin Bieber was saying he's the only famous person that ever came to Stratford. But it was kind of humorous. Anyway, so everyone knows where Stratford is. This was the view into the water plant, washroom in the water plant at one point. Pink foaming water started coming from a consumer's tap. You can't see this in your books, but you probably. So what actually happened? The first hour and a bit of events in Walkerton. The 10 o'clock in the morning, they got a call from a consumer saying, there's pink foaming water coming out of my tap. This was in a home. That was a toilet and a tap for some people, I suppose. Pink foaming water coming from the tap. The water supervisor went and confirmed, yes, in fact, this isn't just a complaint. This is real. 11 o'clock, they actually got to the car wash and shut the water off. That's pretty quick, and it's because an operator on his way into work one day was astute and noticed there was some unusual activity going on at the car wash. He made that connection, and in 40 minutes he knew. And this is something we train operators for on all the time, is this isn't a requirement, but it's a good thing to do. Be aware of what's going on in your system. Now, did you have a backflow prevention bylaw in place?
Yes. There was a backflow better in the place, but somebody
had. I know, that's really surprising. Unless you had taken all the precautions and you were ready to go back into service. Yeah, that is surprising. That is definitely surprising. This was a first, I think, for a lot of people in Stratford. Maybe they looked. The concern was in Stratford that the detergent would interfere with the ability of chlorine to disinfect. So maybe they looked at that and say, well, this isn't going to interfere with disinfection, so this isn't as much of a potential problem. But I can't imagine why they would. I'm surprised. Yeah, because this was a big deal. You'll see in a minute, this was a big deal. So they shut down the car wash. They called the health unit, the MOE. They started flushing hydrants. Bradford is, this happened not smack in the middle of downtown, but close. The car wash was right across the street from the house where the first complaint came in. And it was really interesting, too. The two elderly women lived in this. The end of this was a big ordeal, lasted for about 3 or 4 days. The end of it, Joe Salter, the manager from the water. Media was tramping through their house, and like they were the, there was a sort of, there was a, all the newspapers were there, all the television stations were there. But it was fine. They were quite delighted because they hadn't had so many young men in their house in 30 years. Really cute. That was just kind of cute. But I mean, we can laugh. It was nice we can laugh about this because nothing bad happened. But if this had been something other than, or had been one of many different odorless, colorless chemicals that are deadly, would we deal with time in business? It could have been a completely different story. Pink and foaming, invisible, but lots of things we deal with. But luckily it wasn't. So met with health unit, the MOE, called the drinking water advisory, called out the emergency plan, got all the people together, called all the restaurants to tell them. They didn't know at this stage for sure what it was. They suspected it, but they didn't know the effect. Started to arrange an alternative water supply, issued a drinking water advisory, and this wasn't a boil water advisory. This is a do not use the water for anything advisory. Don't feed it to pets, don't use it for bathing or washing. About the only thing you can use it for is flushing the toilet and car, really. But other than that, I mean, it's pretty major when you think about it. I like this slide because this tells us what we take for granted when we turn the tap on in our water systems every day, what everybody does in your community. Days to replace your water supply. It took, well, this was also to deliver flyers because there were 13,000. I had to deliver water to 390 residents because they were too elderly to get out and get water. 1,000 cases of bottled water, 200,000 liters. $825 staff time. That's what we take, that's what, you know, 2.5 days of water supply. That's take that for granted every time you turn on the tap. But look at this from the point of view of the different barriers. Source protection barrier. Well, there are 11 groundwater wells. There were nothing to do really with the wells at all. Everything was fine. They met all the requirements of the MOE. That barrier was okay. Treatment, they used chlorine for disinfection. There wasn't really any other thing they needed to do because it's a high-quality, secure groundwater, so it really wasn't a result of the problem with the treatment process, so that barrier was okay. Storage, well, it was a direct result of illegal cross-connection. And, again, it actually pumped into the municipal water. The valve wasn't closed, and the pump developed by the car wash was 80 psi in the line. There was a bylaw in place at the time, backflow permit. Required them to have backflow equipment, but it was very hard to enforce. Here's the cross connection. Matter of that little valve there in the middle of the circle normally would be open, top up the water in the system, then closed again. This was probably something that happened on a regular basis for decades prior to the second. So the monitoring barrier, so yeah, the distribution barrier failed. The monitoring barrier, well, there weren't any issues that were relating to monitoring in this as well. They did use the monitoring program they had in place. Problem. I mentioned before that two barriers have to fail. So the second barrier that failed was, you could say, was the management barrier. And it wasn't because they hadn't tried, because there was a backflow prevention bylaw in place, but it was in force. Hang up for backflow prevention, trying to make sure you're enforcing. Very challenging. Great to have a backflow bylaw in place, but if you can't enforce it, that would be the other area. So yeah, again, here's to copy the bylaw, number 50. Bylaw was in place in 2004, and this happened in 2005. There are about, what, 40, 45? In the process of the reason there isn't anything in the Act is because this actually falls under the Municipal Affairs and Housing under the Plumbing Code. It's not actually under the Safe Drinking Water Act, believe it or not. The Ministry of Environment would like it to be, but because it's designated as part of the plumbing system, it's not actually under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Plumbing is outside it. So this is not caught. You could not be held accountable under the standard of care on a backflow issue. Doesn't make much sense, but this is the way it is. Well,
the water pipe, as soon as it hits private property, is backflow prevention is actually noted in the building code. So
it's a good point. No, that's a really good point. And it's I agree, though. It seems to not make sense, but there is logic. The logic is that it's under different. It's a different ministry. Yeah. It's a different ministry. There is a ministry that is involved. It's a different ministry, and it's not mandatory under there. But it's a good idea to do. That's one of the reasons we're talking about. Is it's important because we recognize it as a good potential source of contaminants. We're going to keep it safe. You know, good thing to do. So we did talk about this. Looks like you're well underway. So that's absolutely fantastic. There's a guidance document that's available, and don't need this now because you're, sounds like that. But it is a good guidance document. Some case study summary here. We know that fecal contamination, waste, animal waste, and human pathogens from this contamination is virtually everywhere. We know that some pathogens are hard to treat, and we talked. I didn't mention the outbreak in Milwaukee in 1993. Somewhere between 50 and 112 people died. 4 billion man hours. This was the first the water industry was this big way. Apparently particularly nasty for AIDS patients. And at virtually exactly the same time, and this flew under the radar, sort of like your outbreak of the same organism at the same time. Complacency can result from fractions, really because these are relatively rare. So you're not going to think of water as being the first place. Our water is clean and safe and pristine. Can't let down our guard. In terms of distribution systems, they're particularly vulnerable because you don't see them for the most part. We also know that more so now than ever that leaks in pipes can actually cause contaminants to come inside. Cross connections certainly can be. That's it. This is a quick last segment here. Just some practical steps. A lot of this is talked about to some degree already. Good common sense, not necessarily for, it's good for any organization, really. Got good communications, good channels of communication. Try to promote this mentality of continuous improvement. And if you look at this, not just saying, hey, we're doing a good job now, try to think of ways to even do better. Adopted this at the center. Let's see if we can make a difference. Promote the understanding of the entire system, especially the limitations. You got to know what your system is. Maintaining those robust barriers. Are able to recognize new things coming along. Also identified by training. Talking about the things that are most recent. Make sure staff know they are entrusted with protecting public health, and this is something we're driving home with operators all the time. Justice O'Connor said that operational personnel, status of training, the compensation that compares with everything. Got a brand new plant. Let's see. Lucky already. Waterloo as well. But this was, these are modern plants with full. Add virtually all the belt. Also, too, we think disease outbreaks are rare, but really, given the fact that we know that they're underreported, they're still. ...188 that were likely outbreaks. It does happen. It is happening. Really quickly, MOE inspections, we talked a little bit about this. Every year they will do an inspection. They're very thorough. They're exhaustive. They look at all aspects of your system, source treatment. They can be really valuable if you get a good inspector. They can be real. But the from the point of view of counsel, part of that report probably in the very. It also gives you a bit of a report card. Are you doing better or worse than last time? I think my recommendation would be, and if Grant agrees, probably already do get it, have a look at the high-level summary of those inspection reports, not the detailed work, just. Is there any area of non-compliance that's been identified? Is some area of non-compliance, then put a plan. That's not, again, high-level summary of a paragraph, really, is what it is. But again, and even if there's something identified that needs to be done, you don't necessarily have to do it tomorrow. You have to put a plan in place, address it, deal with it. addition to that, there are water quality reports and summary reports that, that staff are preparing. And high-level summary, areas of non-compliance, areas where there are problems is really all you need. Obviously, then the council should be looking. Making sure you have staff have a training plan. Again, this is something that I expect is happening already based on my knowledge. The idea to make sure that staff are getting relevant, not just convenient ones. Another thing to recognize, too, is succession planning. You've got a lot of people eligible to retire. Now, you've got a Class 3 distribution report. Less than that, but still, it's a significant amount of time to get someone up to speed. Mind that you've got people retiring. And this is a tricky one for council because what ideally you would have is the ability to have, bring a new person on, have them shadow. Halliford, the guy retired, those junior guys were left holding the bag. You really offer of some sort, so you're not just throwing someone into a job that has no background. Just something to think about from the point of view of. But it's hard to justify two salaries, you know, if you're trying to hire someone to shadow the other person. That's consulting fees now. So just finally, foster competence, eliminate, these sound easy, eliminate complacency, just snap your fingers. Eliminate complacency. It's not unusual to be in a municipality. Building a culture of prevention instead of reaction. In this industry, if people are willing to share the opportunity to look at them. A lot of this is sort of along the lines of the let's pretty much it. Record time. Any questions at all? I have, if you think of something later. Answers or questions to, it ends up going to the MOE lawyer.
Hey, Brian, just to go back on this whole process and this whole training and everything, with the ministry, here's my question. We're supposed to do our due diligence. We're supposed to make sure that we're well-informed. And then there's, you talk about compliance and you talk about the regulations. You need to know this. You need to do that. Is there something from the ministry that gives you some kind of a guideline that says, here's some of the things that is important that a municipality has in place to be compliant?
Right, right.
Because, you know, they keep saying, you know, you got to be compliant with all these things, but as a counselor, that's what I'm looking at. Not so much Grant, but as a counselor, and especially new counselors coming in,
right,
they don't know.
That's what this guide was intended to do. That I handed everybody one, and this was available for download on their website for a couple of years. But that's what this is designed to be. It's everything you should know about your water system. It talks about the regulation. It's the standard of care is sort of addresses that as well. It's I've told you a few things. There isn't any requirement that you look at the MOE inspection reports, but if you're ever going to get nailed on something, if you're ever going to get into trouble for something, it would be for something like where an inspection report said something, there's a problem, and you didn't respond to it effectively or at all, and they came back and said, well, we told you about it, it's right here. So that's why I'm suggesting look at the MOE inspection reports. But there's really only a few things you'd have to really pay a lot of attention to. That would be one of them, MOE inspection reports, making sure there's no areas of noncompliance. Listening to staff, they're going to bring these things forward. Grant, staff would be bringing these things forward to you for sure. If there's a MOE inspection report that's listed noncompliance, I'm sure you'd hear about it. So listen to that. Do you report to council for all meetings or... Okay, so whatever information is bringing forward, and sometimes it's overwhelming, but staff can usually do a reasonable job of summarizing it fairly concisely, and we'd hope for that. So it's not, I know that you can have stacks and stacks and stacks of things to review, it can be overwhelming, but there can be ways to make that simple. It doesn't need to be exhaustive. But again, water quality reports, MOE inspection reports, risk assessment reports from the operational plan. Those are going to pick off the areas where you may be looking at. Actually, not that much, to be honest. It sounds like a lot, but if you looked at just those three things, and you're doing it already, you're already doing it. So take some comfort in that. In addition to all this, I mentioned there's a whole lot of fail-safes have been put in place to prevent a problem from happening again, so likelihood of something bad happening is much less than it had been previous, but we still have to be on guard. Doesn't mean that you have to spend every penny that they come and ask you for, necessarily. I mean, if you can afford to do the things that are important, absolutely. If you can't, you could plan to deal with it in the future. That answer your question?
Yep, thanks.
Hey, I do have a quick, anybody that wants CEUs and a nice little certificate, I've got a little multiple choice test that's actually, it's optional, but it's kind of fun. Ideas or thoughts that you'd like, of course, in another... there's opportunities to
Thank you very much, Brian. While you're passing that out, I just want to let everyone know who's potentially listening at home, because we are live streaming, that the quorum dissolved, so we'll be passing no resolutions as we don't have an official council available to do so. So once we do the quiz here and turn it into you, we'll call it a night. Unless you have any closing remarks, Grant, you'd like to make? You're welcome.